I'm going to give a little bit different take. A lot of the material that I'm going to talk about is going to be quite similar to what Michael talked about, but it's going to be from a different perspective. I'm going to be talking a little bit more from the receive side of things rather than the transmit side. And secondly, this is going to be more of a marketing pitch rather than an engineering pitch, so you'll have to bear with me. I think that the from a standpoint of why is it important to get the perspective from the chip makers really are driving three things. They're driving the cost of these systems, and as you know today, the digital televisions that are out there are wildly expensive. They're moving down, and the chip makers are largely responsible for moving down the cost curve. And so we're trying to drive further improvements in our technology and our cost standpoints to move these things to a point that they're affordable for the community at large. The second thing, really, from a standpoint of performance, the receiver is what's setting and what's the view of the community, again, a community at large. So the chip makers are really driving the performance of these systems. And the third point is that we're really driving the schedule. There's a lot that goes into making these little bitty pieces of silicon, these little black pieces of plastic, but there's a tremendous amount of development that goes into them. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the schedule and why it's taking a long time to get this VSB up and running. Orin, which is my company, has been focused for a long time on the wireless problem. And from a receiver standpoint, Michael touched on it quite a bit. There's a lot of things that can happen when you're talking about a wireless system that really impact the performance. People walking in front of the antennas, this indoor antenna problem that's been discussed over and over again, is a serious issue. Planes, any kind of dynamic moving object is a problem that impacts and affects a wireless system. And so it's important to have technology that can react and fix wireless problems, and that's what we've been focused on. A little background on us as a company. We're a privately held company. We started in about 1995. We just recently, this week, announced a major equity investment from Sony. We've enjoyed a very strong partnership with Sony, and the equity investment represents a serious step forward for us. We got started as all good Israeli companies, and our major engineering effort is actually in Israel, focused on defense. And those guys like to spend a lot of time on that for some reason or another. And we were part of that in developing large digital filters for the military industry. The first product that we did was an analog ghost canceller. And a while ago, there was a little add-on set-top box introduced by Philips that was specifically focused on getting out the ghosts in analog TV broadcasts. We developed a lot of the circuitry in that box for Philips and have continued. The majority of our sales today are actually in Japan, because the Japanese market is still characterized by a preponderance of people using and receiving broadcast TV. There's very little penetration of cable and satellite in Japan. We took the technology and the experience that we learned in this analog realm into the manufacture and development of digital demodulators. And we were one of the first companies that got into digital demodulation. That started about 1998. We're now on our fourth generation of product, and we're just getting set to release that. We've got a booth at NAB that's going to talk and introduce that technology. Michael talked quite a bit about VSB demodulation or modulation, again, from a transmit side. From a receive perspective, what's important? Well, there's a known series, as he talked about, a known series of digital bits that is sent repetitively throughout the transmission cycle that is used to train the chip. You have to have a reference point to start from, and the reference point is this training sequence that is sent repetitively through the signal. And what we do is we use that training sequence to train our equalizer, which is basically a series of multipliers that is trying to take and correct a garbage signal, as you see on the left, and create something that's recognizable and can be used by the TV to actually display picture. So we use a bunch of digital signal processing techniques to do this. And digital signal processors are rather complex beasts, but Orin as a company has a unique approach in that most of the digital signal processing actually occurs in software rather than on the IC level itself. Rather than using circuits to do the digital signal processing, we're using software and software units that can perform a lot of the hardware functions that other companies, other receiver manufacturers have traditionally employed. In strong multipath, one of the big issues that happens is that that training sequence can become corrupted. You can't depend anymore on the series, the known series of ones and zeros that train the equalizer to give you a meaningful and replicable set of data. So one of the techniques that's commonly employed is what's called blind or predictive equalization. And this is, you're sort of taking a guess or a stab on where the ones and the zeros actually lie in the system and using that predictive information to then train the equalizer and correct for the multipath, correct the corruptions that are happening during the transmission. If you remember your old algebra, your old calculus, there was a thing called a Taylor series, which is a long series of coefficients and multipliers, x1, x squared, x cubed, and so on, that if you use enough of those, you can exactly replicate any input can be replicated to any output. Well, the math that's used in this is basically like a Taylor series, where we're using this training sequence to generate the coefficients, to calculate coefficients in our digital signal processor to get the input to look like a stored reference, to look like the series of ones and zeros that we know should be coming in from the training sequence. And so in the end, the theory is that any input can be replicated and regenerated to a perfect output. And part of that, as Michael alluded to, is using forward error correction. There's a lot of this interleaving techniques that go into making the data more robust and more able to regenerate the output signal based on an input signal of any, no matter how garbagey it looks. Demodulators are, again, an essential part of the system. They sit basically between the tuner and the MPEG decoder. The MPEG decoder is what's actually playing back or regenerating the audio and the video sequence. The demodulator, in basic terms, is taking this mixed signal, which is essentially, even though it's digital TV, it's actually an analog signal, converting it down to a form that the MPEG transport chip, the MPEG decoder chip, can use. So we're taking essentially analog data that comes from the RF domain, comes from a tuner. We're doing a down conversion. We actually accept an IF frequency, a 44 megahertz IF frequency, do a down conversion, which is the normal technology that's used today, digitize that signal, put it in a format that the MPEG-2 decoder chip can use, basically an MPEG data stream, and then that's played back on a digital television system. This is a fairly complex block diagram of the inside of our chip, the chip that we're introducing today, but it gives a good look and feel as to what's happening. The first thing is the signal is coming in on the upper left-hand corner of the diagram there. It goes into an ADD converter. The ADD converter obviously is taking the analog signal and digitizing it. And our ADD converter is a 10-bit ADD converter. It's taking the analog information and converting it to 10 bits of digital information. But even that isn't really accurate enough. We use an interpolator after the ADD converter to get further resolution on the digital data, to generate more bits of information that our chip can use. And the interpolator is just taking the data points and predicting and adding more digital information on which we can do some operations. The demodulation function that's happening is you're converting that digital information, you're extracting the carrier, which is the modulating signal, you're extracting the pilot that Michael talked about, you're looking for adjacent channels, you're looking for co-channels, and there's an NTSC co-channel detector that is in that block that's eliminating interferers from the basic data. And then it goes through the match filter. The match filter's function is essentially to correlate or eliminate defects that happen in the tuner. The tuner function is usually imperfect. There's tilt. There's problems in the tuner that a match filter, which is sort of a coarse adjust block, if you think about it that way, can take out and eliminate some of the imperfections introduced by the tuner. And then that goes into the equalization block, which is what we talked about. The equalizer is essentially the multiplier that's generating the coefficients that is trying to transform this corrupt signal into something that's recognizable for the forward error correction blocks. The calculation for those coefficients is happening in the digital signal processing unit. The digital processor is sort of like a microcontroller. It's managing the activity in the equalizer, it's managing the activity in the FEC block, it's the sort of the watchdog of the entire system. And then there's memory banks that are shuffling data into and out of that the DSP unit. The forward error correction block, which is sort of the last thing, is undoing all the stuff that the transmission side put into the signal. It's de-interleaving, de-randomizing, all the things that Michael went through in his talk. The forward error correction on a receive side is undoing or backing all of that information out so that you end up with an MPEG-2 transport stream, which is a format that is recognized by decoders. From an IC side, again, the IC development is really what's driving the cost, the schedule, the performance of the things that would end up in the homes if digital TV is going to penetrate more and more of the houses out there. There's a lot involved in integrated circuit development. Again, it's a little plastic piece of junk, a very small, insignificant looking block of material, but there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into developing one of those chips. There's a certain amount of marketing. Our team has marketing that's getting involved in sort of defining this initial specification. Systems engineering, which has to understand the transmission side and the receive side, and they get involved in writing the specs that our VLSI team, which is the circuit team, take and implement and generate circuits from. And then there's a whole set of work that goes into forming and developing new algorithms. A good portion of our company is focused on thinking up new ways to take in this VSB standard, innovate the VSB standard, and develop software and algorithms that are going to be better enable reception of the standard. Once we have the chip, there's a whole team of folks that put together the IC on a board that a customer like a Sony or like a Hughes or some of our customers would be able to use. Generally, the end system, the receivers that you see on the market, don't have a lot of circuit expertise and rely on the chip maker to develop a reference design that they take and copy and put into production. So we have to do all of the, understand how the tuner fits, how the MPEG decoder fits, where our chip fits in the system, and really give a kit to the manufacturers that they turn around and produce and generate product from that ends up on the store shelves. And the very last phase is obviously product engineering. And the product engineering from an IC standpoint really means testing the chips, making sure the chips are meeting the specs that we say they do. And there's a tremendous amount of effort taken in writing test programs, looking for ways to wiggle all the individual nodes, all the individual circuit blocks that are inside a chip. You have to come up with vectors that are going to be wiggling each of those nodes to ensure that the chip that actually goes out the door and ends up in a Sony set-top box, for example, is a functional and working piece of silicon. That said, a typical flow for an IC manufacturer is about 20 months. A little less than 2 years it takes us from developing the specification for an IC to kicking one out the door that would end up on the receivers, end up on the store shelves. And one of the issues that's happened with VSB has been a very slow, iterative process toward getting better performing ICs. And part of the reason for that is how long it's taking the IC manufacturers to get these things working and get these things to a point that the technology is viable. The COFDM folks, the DVB-T chip makers, had a significant lead. DVB-T was actually a set and finalized standard far in advance of VSB. So the VSB chip makers have had to sort of scramble from behind in an environment that is not so conducive. There's obviously a lot of public focus on what's happening in the market, and have had to try to come from behind to innovate the technology to the point that the COFDM sits today. And I think we're making a lot of strides, and we'll talk a little bit now about some of the innovation that's happening from ourselves and some other companies trying to improve this standard and make it to the point that it's actually a viable product and we can get the kind of coverage that Michael alluded to. To sort of summarize, from a chip standpoint, there's a lot of different groups. There's the marketing and system engineering setting the spec, the VLSI, that's the actual circuit team, taking that specification, drawing up the circuits, drawing up the various electrical blocks that make this type of chip work, the hardware team that's developing the chip, the boards, the PCB boards, the surrounding circuitry that drive the entire system, the algorithm team that does the software that actually drives the IC. Today, chips are heavily, there's a big combination between software and hardware that takes place, and there are a lot more and more of the circuit development that actually occurs is done in software rather than hardware. And then there's a whole round of field testing, and as the ATSC standard was set through months and years of field testing, we have to do the same thing on the receive side. We ourselves spend vast numbers of hours in the field going to various locations that we know have problems that are specifically difficult for the receivers to handle. And we've joined various companies in field tests and spend a lot of our own time trying to iterate and figure out what's happening to break these types of chips. The good news and a little bit of a pitch for us, for Orin, is that there is innovation in this area. And we feel that the next family of chips that we're going to introduce are going to fix the problem or enhance the capabilities of VSB. We've taken a very unique approach, and that is to combine a bunch of algorithms, a bunch of modulation standards into a single IC. It turns out that the back end circuitry, the MPEG decoders that I talked about earlier, are common in a satellite system, in a cable system, in a terrestrial broadcast system. The only thing that's really different are, to a certain extent, the tuners, and to a very significant extent, these demodulation ICs. And what we have brought to the table by using this software-based approach is the ability to have one chip that can receive satellite, that can receive cable, that can receive broadcast television, and not only that, it can receive the European standard, the COFDM, and it can receive the VSB standard. It can receive analog and receive digital, so it's a truly multi-standard chip that runs the gamut of all modulation standards, all transmission schemes that are currently employed. The chip is developed using probably the state-of-the-art technology today, a 0.18 micron process. There's five layers of metal, which is the layers that form the interconnect. The circuit wiring is done in metal. And in polysilicon, there's three layers of polysilicon on this chip. And we use TSMC, which is a very common foundry in Taiwan, to do our manufacturing. They're basically the state-of-the-art foundry today in terms of process technology for ICs. So this now gives a feel for how this would be put into play. You can have one chip, again, with two tuner satellite is a 24 megahertz channel. So you need another tuner to handle that. But cable, analog, and terrestrially broadcast signals are all based on a 6 megahertz channel. You can use one tuner, and the system is basically now a common system. This is what's going to drive the cost down going forward and enable the consumer manufacturers to introduce digitally broadcast television at basically no expense. If they have a satellite system, they can use a chip like ours or some other manufacturers, throw that in and have a box that's capable of receiving satellite or terrestrially broadcast signal. Michael alluded before to this T3S9 task force, and the T3S9 task force has been tasked by the ATSC to look at ways to improve the standard, and hopefully that those improvements will be backward compatible to the existing standard so that we're not obsoleting those 5 or 10 receivers that are actually out there. We have some ideas. There's several other companies. Michael alluded, there's 10 proposals on the table. We're one of the 10 proposals. What we are doing that I think is interesting, I'll talk a little bit about some of the results that we've seen and the improvements and the points that are significant to specific problems in the VSB environment. But what we are doing is we're taking advantage of basically frequency domain techniques to improve the reception of VSB. And VSB has largely in the past been a time domain algorithm based on iterating and slowly converging your equalizer towards a final solution using an LMS or a least mean squared algorithm. The problem with using the traditional approach, a time-based approach, is, as I say, you're iterating down to a solution. So if something happens in the channel that is a fast event, like a fast dynamic ghost, a car going by the window, or an airplane flying overhead, or somebody walking around in the room right in front of the antenna, the equalizer really can't react to it. And you end up with the cliff effect. You end up with no picture being on the television screen. And this has been the knock consistently on VSB. There are two things that really we've seen in the field, other manufacturers have seen in the field, that are real problems that we feel we can address by using a frequency domain technique. The two problems are first, indoor antenna, which means you have a little set of rabbit ears on top of the TV. People walking in front of that rabbit ears creates a fading effect. The main carrier, the main strongest signal, is blocked from the antenna, and as a result, the picture goes away for just an instant. For a flash, the picture drops out. The second problem is with strong near ghosts. We've done some field testing in San Francisco, for example, right under Sutro Tower, which is the main broadcast antenna in San Francisco. We've done testing right underneath the antenna itself and picking up reflections from some of the buildings that sit behind Sutro Tower. And in that environment, our receivers traditionally have broken. They've lost lock.
And what time domain or frequency domain analysis allows you to do is handle those very short, very close ghosts that are close in, when you're getting a reflection bouncing off a building that is very close to the main carrier and very strong. We can handle that, or we feel we can handle that, using some frequency domain approaches. What the FFT, or the fast Fourier transform, which is a frequency dependent technique, allows us to do is to get a real-time channel snapshot. We can see all the ghosts that are appearing in the channel, the positions of those ghosts, and then quickly get our equalizer trained and focused on canceling out those ghosts. So in one pass, we can get the taps of the filter allocated to the standpoint that they can cancel out ghosts, whereas before we would have to learn on each pass and slowly iterate towards the final solution. Now we can do it in one pass, and that's enabling us to solve both of these problems, the dynamic ghost problem and the very strong near ghost problem. Here's a picture of what our old receiver looked like. This is a dynamic channel. The channel profile is shown up in the left-hand corner. This is the position of ghosts that appear inside the channel. And the two right graphs are the finite impulse response filter. An FIR filter is used to get rid of pre-ghosts. And pre-ghosts are ghosts that essentially appear before your carrier. They're reflections that they could actually have been the main transmitted signal, but are reduced or attenuated and arrive before what is chosen as the main carrier, the strongest signal. And the strongest signal is always the highest point in the graph there. The IIR, the infinite impulse response, is used to filter out post-ghosts. Anything that happens after the main carrier uses IIR taps. Now this uses our old technology, and you can see the lower left quadrant is what the 8 VSB symbol looks like. And this, we actually lock to this particular symbol. It looks like a blob of points, but using our old receiver, we lock to it, but not very well. This was a signal-to-noise ratio of about 15.3 dB, which is right around the threshold of visibility. This is where you're going to start to see blockiness in the picture. You're going to start to see signs that the cliff is coming near. So using the old techniques, we were very close to the threshold of visibility, and we're virtually losing the carrier lock. Employing this FFT approach, or this frequency domain approach, you can see two things. One, this is the way the 8 VSB levels are supposed to look. Michael had alluded previously to the 8 levels. This is how it looks when it's sliced out. The data is supposed to lie along 8 different lines. And you can see, by using the frequency domain approach in a dynamic channel, we were able to basically replicate what the 8 VSB signal is supposed to look like. And you can see a much more active response from the finite impulse response filter up in the upper right. Many more taps are active, and what it's indicating is that we were able to model a channel much, much better using this approach than we were using the LMS approach, the old approach to doing this kind of thing. This, what we got out of this was a signal-to-noise ratio that was close to 25. So there's 10 dB of improvement, and 10 dB is very, very significant in terms of its response and ability to handle these fast dynamic ghosts. And so this is a response to the fast dynamics. The next one, our LMS, this is the strong near ghost, which is the second example that has been particularly problematic in the field. In the strong, very near ghosts, our old receiver was not able to lock at all. It did not lock to the carrier. Our new technology, using this frequency-based equalization, was it not only able to lock, but you can see here it even got a better signal noise ratio than did the dynamic case that I showed before. We got a signal to noise ratio here of about 29 dB, where again, the old technology wasn't able to lock at all. The summary of what I think is from an IC standpoint is that we're looking for a collaboration between the broadcasters and the chip makers. We now have an effort underway where we have employed some of our new ideas into broadcasts, and we've worked with some broadcast partners to implement our technique and do some field studies to see that it actually is working as well as we simulate and as well as we think it's going to work. We have a field program right now in the San Jose area with KICU where they've implemented our change to the broadcasts on the, from the broadcast side so that we can go out and do some field studies ourselves and again make sure that this technique is going to work as well as we think it is. The innovation takes time. Michael said that he's a believer in VSB. I'm a believer in VSB as well. It's been a slow process, but I think that as time evolves, we're going to get the price point down. We're going to get to the point where this standard actually works for the broadcast community and for the consumer community. And I think that it's going to be something that is going to be a successful standard. There was a reason that was chosen. All the reasons that Michael alluded to in his speech are correct. And I think that we can get this thing to the point where it works for the United States. So the last point is there's hope. I think that there's been a lot of bashing of the 8VSB standard, but there's a lot of innovation happening, a lot of activity happening in this area, and we feel that this is going to be a standard that works. That's my my show.
We have a few moments. Could you take a few questions?
Where exactly on the 20-month timeline that you had on there are these chips?
This generation that's using the frequency domain, we should be sampling in the summertime. We've got our first silicon back that we're just starting to do some field testing with, and we expect to have these things in our consumer partners, the Sonys, the Panasonics of the world, sometime in the summer.
You alluded to some testing that you're doing on the West Coast with KICU, that you are doing something different about the 8VSB transmission signal. Are you adding some new signals to it?
Yeah, this is a backward compatible approach, and we have done what we've done to ensure backward compatibility is we've gone out and we've tested every receiver that's currently available on the market with this swizzle that we're putting in. What we're doing specifically is we're introducing additional training to help the equalizer. You need some more, to use a frequency domain type approach, you need additional information to get that perfect channel model. And the way to do that is obviously introduce more training. And we've used some data packets in the transmitted space that are not used by any other receiver to introduce a repetitive cycle that we can take advantage of.
Okay, then the question is, how much is that overhead that you're adding to the transport stream?
Again, it's from a data standpoint, there's no loss in actual throughput. These are prefixes that were used to support some of the 16 VSB work that was supposed to be done for cable. And since that basically isn't being used, it's something that we can take advantage of without impacting the data throughput.
Yeah, you mentioned there were going to be other companies involved in this too. Will there be a standard so that all receivers act the same? We got receivers now at our facility, and four of them all act different. It's kind of a joke, really.
Yeah. I think that's very true, first of all. I mean, we've seen the same thing. We've gone out in field testing with receivers that use our chips and receivers that use other chips. And, you know, frankly, our chips will break when other receivers work. Other receivers will break when our chips work. That really isn't a sign of a standardization. It's a sign of the immaturity of the technology. And we're starting to iterate and work on it. Other companies are. And I think as this experience grows, you're going to see a convergence to the point where all receivers will work in all conditions all the time. But right now, it is real scattered. I mean, we're seeing the same thing that you are, and our chips are part of the problem.
You mentioned this would drive the cost of the DTV set down. It seems to me like I remember the display really is the major cost factor in a set. How much do you expect your chip technology then to be able to drive the cost down?
That's a good point. The display is a significant portion of it, but the electronics also are major contributors. What's happened from a VSB standpoint is that the electronics that drive that have started out in the $800 type price range, and now we're seeing the electronics come down to the sub $300 range, and we think it's going to be down below $200 probably before the end of this year. So yes, the display is a big portion of it, but the electronics are also a contributor. And we're seeing, as we work with some of our partners, that the display technology is coming down in price as well. And I think the combined result will be probably in 2002, you'll see these things get down to the point where the majority of people can afford them.
Thank you. Thank you.